Welcome back to another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast. Today we had Bill Coor on, and thanks to his gracious time, this is another two-part edition. So look for part two of the podcast to drop on Monday morning, and enjoy part one. If you're new to the podcast, please subscribe to our channel on iTunes or Stitcher. And if you've been a subscriber and enjoy it, please drop us a review.
I miss a green, for example. I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
Fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg lie, I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast. Today, I'm joined by noted golf course architect Bill Coor from the Coor Crenshaw Design Firm. Bill has designed some of the world's greatest courses, including Sand Hills, Friar's Head, Lost Farm at Barn Boogle Dunes, and today we're at one of his newest courses, Sand Valley. Bill, welcome on.
Thank you, Andy. Thank you for coming out with the... has turned out to be the coldest day of the year here in Wisconsin.
Yes, as a Chicagoan, I know to not schedule outdoor activities in Wisconsin in mid-November unless it's like skiing.
Right. I think that would have been maybe more apropos than what we did.
Yeah, but I think getting a good thaw, like a good first cold in, it's going to set me up for the winter. You're going to go back to warm places, yeah. But I'm set up for winter now.
Yeah, you're prepared. Your introduction is over. Yeah. It's now winter.
Yeah. So I want to kick things off. Something I've heard is that you consider Old Town Club to be one of the most significant courses in your architectural career, and just curious why Old Town, what about it is so significant and, you know, has shaped the way you think?
Well, Andy, I think it's primarily because I grew up in North Carolina, and so I grew up playing basically on very, very affordable courses. I'm talking very affordable, which meant they weren't necessarily at the top of the scale in terms of architecture usually. But I was also able to be exposed to courses like Pinehurst No. 2 and like Old Town Club. And those two courses, I think, came together to form my understanding, they became the cornerstone of my understanding of what interesting golf course architecture was all about. So I was exposed to Pinehurst first. But then when I was at Wake Forest for 4 years there, and Old Town Club literally being adjacent to, connected to, basically, the campus, I would walk there with my golf bag in the afternoons and begin playing golf. And the students could do that at the time for $1. They could play Old Town Club for $1. You signed in, paid your dollar, and you played, even though it was a private club. But Old Town... The more I played it, the more I realized that it was just fascinating. And the more I began to think about golf architecture and actually study golf architecture, the more I began to realize how truly gifted Old Town was and what Perry Maxwell did there on that site.
Mm-hmm. What was so special about what Maxwell did about the different, you know, features?
Well, I think, first of all, it's a small site, and it's quite hilly. So if you wanted to study how to lay a golf course on a fairly severe piece of ground, and yet a fairly small piece of ground in terms of acreage, I know of no better place to do it than Old Town, because of the way Mr. Maxwell laid the holes out across those hills and the valleys and made them work. Even though they're in close proximity to each other, you don't ever feel like you're in danger necessarily when you're playing golf. He just did it in such a beautiful fashion. And like so many things, that when it's well done, it looks so simple. And so I played Old Town for a long, long time before it finally struck me as to, gee, how did he actually make this work? How do you get all these holes on this small piece of ground and make them work? And so from a routing standpoint, it's an extraordinary study and example.
Yeah. You hear a lot of architects have like a moment where they know they want to be like, you know, where they become into architecture, and like whether it's playing a great course, was it at Old Town where you really had like the architectural awakening, or did it happen before at Pinehurst?
Neither one, actually. Those two went together, as I said, to form my earliest impressions of what really interesting golf architecture was about. But no, it was actually after I had graduated from Wake Forest, and I was about to go to graduate school at Duke, and Uncle Sam decided that I should make a bit of a detour. And so I had spent 2 years in the Army, and as I was about to get out, I saw a golf course near my home in North Carolina, in a town called High Point, North Carolina. And a man by the name of Pete Dye was designing a course there. And the course was called Oak Hollow Public Golf Course. And I had never heard of Pete Dye, and I knew nothing about this golf course. And somebody said, oh, they're building a new golf course not so far away. And I remember when I was, I had a weekend away there from the Army, and I'd gone home, and I went out to look at it, and it's when Pete was doing things very much like Harbortown. Shorter courses, finesse, railroad sleepers, the whole thing people think about. And it was just fascinating to me. This was, of course, in the era of Robert Trent Jones Sr., and when I saw this golf course, I thought, gosh, that's very interesting. And I think more than anything, Andy, that's when out there that day, walking around, the course wasn't open yet, but it wasn't too far away from opening. And I just remember thinking, I wonder how you do this. I love golf. And I think I know a good course when I see one, but how does this happen? What's the process? And, you know, having been away from school for over 2 years, it's that decision making. Do I go to graduate school? And then I'm thinking, well, I'm single. I don't need much money or anything. I could, I might like to see how this is done. So I remember the guy who was out there watering. It was on a Sunday afternoon. The guy was out there watering the course. I asked him who did it. He said, some man named Dye. And again, it didn't mean anything to me at the time. This was in 1971. And I said, do you know how to get in touch with him? He said, oh, I'm sure his name's in the superintendent's Rolodex. And here we walk. He drove me back to the maintenance shop. We walked in there, and he takes the old-fashioned Rolodex where you turn it around with all the, you know, cards, flip cards with names and addresses and phone numbers. And sure enough, he finds it. Finds Pete, he gives me his number. I began calling Pete, badgered him to see if I could get a job, just to see how this was done. So that was the moment, really.
How long did it take to get a job?
Quite a while, actually. I mean, I called Pete. I remember I blatantly made up a story that I was going to be in Florida, which I really didn't have any reason to be in Florida, but as soon as I was going to get my discharge from the military. And he said, well, if you're ever down here, you know, call me. So I made my way down to Florida after I was discharged from the military, and I called him. And he, interestingly enough, it was another, of all things, on a Sunday afternoon. And Pete was, he was a huge Miami Dolphin. And this is in the time when the Dolphins were dominant.
Yeah.
You know, the year, actually, I think that they went undefeated.
Shula.
Don Shula, Larry Zonka, Bob Green, these guys. You know, it's just, Pete was such a huge fan.
They had the 72 Dolphins. That's it. Yeah. So they went undefeated, right? Yeah,
I think so. I think so. So I remember calling, and Pete, he had no interest whatsoever in what I wanted to talk about. But I do remember he said, "Where are you?" I said, "Well, I'm at the whatever it is. I can't remember, some little hotel there, Delray Beach." And he said, "Sure, I can talk to you." He said, "I'll be over there." I'm like, what? He's going to come over here? He wanted to watch the football game. He had a bunch of folks at his house. He came over there. I didn't know what to look for. I didn't know what he looked like or anything. I'm just asking people as they walk in the door, "Are you Pete Dunne?" They all look at him. No. Well, then he walks in and he says, "So you want to talk about golf architecture?" I said, "Yes." He said, "All right, let's go to your room." I'm like, "What?" And so here we go to my room. He plops down on the bed and gets the TV face, turns the football game on. That's all he wanted to do was watch the football game. So he sort of absentmindedly talked to me while he watched the football game. So and then he said, "Well, we're going to be doing a golf course up near home in North Carolina." It turned out to be the Cardinal Club in Greensboro. Uh-huh. He said, "You can come out there and maybe we'll find something for you to do." It was another year or more after that that they actually started the Cardinal. I went out there. Pete didn't remember me from anybody. I mean, he just, but he.
Hey, you were, you served.
I was persistent.
And you served an immediate need. You fixed his problem. You wanted to watch the Dolphins, and you're probably a great excuse for him to get out of town.
Exactly. He was able to sit there and watch the entire game. Game was over, gone. It was just one of those sort of odd things that happens.
What, everybody talks about the railroad ties, and then, people remember him for the TPC courses he built, the regular fan, but, what would you say is the most underappreciated aspect of Pete Dye's work as an architect?
He changed the direction of golf architecture twice. Yeah, no one else has ever done that. I mean, he started, he first changed it with courses like Harbortown, when Robert Trent Jones Sr. was doing the exact opposite, doing, par 72, 7,000 yard championship golf courses. That was the thing. That was the motto. That was the selling point. Pete went the exact opposite direction. Shorter, finesse courses, quirky. He and Alice had seen the railroad ties when they played a lot in Scotland and thought, well, that could work. We can do some of that. And it was just something that people in this country, unless they had traveled to Scotland or Ireland, they just weren't used to. So the fact that Harbortown was so well received, I think the first tournament there was in 1970, and if I recall, Arnold Palmer won.
Yeah,
and so the fact it was so well received instantly put him, in the public eye as far as a golf course architect. And then pretty soon, everything you saw started going in that direction. Mm-hmm. Well, then when the TPC Jacksonville came in, which was many years later, but he changed it again, completely. There. So I know no one else who's done that, who's actually changed. And once Pete did Harbortown and the finesse course type situation, and then when he changed to the more challenging, longer, however you want to describe it, TPC type course, the next thing you saw was everyone was doing the same. It was just he literally changes not just the direction, but if you watch the progression, you saw many courses appear like Pete's early course at Harbortown, but then after TPC you saw many courses appear that suddenly looked like that golf course.
Yeah, the architecture industry through time has changed so many times. It's different. it's kind of crazy, but for one man to do it twice.
Yeah, I know no one else has done that.
So a lot of people say that Pete Dye was a penal architect versus a strategic one. What would you consider him being?
Well, Andy, I think certainly I'm a bit partial to Pete's Harbortown, so to speak, phase, where finesse was a little more at the cornerstone of the golf course. And I think then they were extraordinarily strategic, playing to certain positions to get to other, to get to angles and things. I think as Pete saw the game changing, meaning players hitting the ball farther and farther and farther. And I think as he then changed to try to challenge those players at the TPC courses, they were still strategic. They were certainly strategic for, you know, the best players. They still wanted to play to certain positions, usually right next to some very visible hazard. And T would always give you something to look at. There was always something in your eye as a player. And more often than not, if you could play close to that, you had an advantage in some way. But, I think Pete and Alice and the work that they've done through the years is just some absolutely fascinating courses. And yet you do hear about, well, it's very penal. I think a lot of that depends on what tees you play from. I think a lot of it, is a situation that's more the impression that comes from the TPC course type phase of their architecture. So, I see it as strategic and penal both.
I agree. I think I fall on the strategic side because I grew up playing Pete Dye course in Florida every family vacation. And still when I go there, it's all angles and you do have to be a little bit better of a player, but the strategy is so good and all that stuff. I had Brian Silva on the podcast a few months ago, and he said he had an architectural awakening when he was sitting in a doctor's waiting room looking at a Sports Illustrated, and he saw the aerial of PGA West, and all of a sudden a light bulb went off about the angles and how it fundamentally changed the way you design courses. And it not many architects could do that, so.
Yeah, no, it's, again, Pete and Alice were amazing with that. And the thing they were able to do, too, I think, Andy's, they could do some really unusual type contouring, whether you want to call it the mounds or the railroad ties along the water, and then the certain types of greens, shapes and angles, but some really abrupt things that people weren't necessarily used to seeing, and yet they worked.
Yeah.
It's very, very seldom you'll ever see a Pete Dye golf course, even a hole on a Pete Dye golf course, that doesn't function from a playing standpoint. And the other people who then said, oh, that's what's selling now, that's what I'm going to produce, oftentimes didn't have the same insight as to how you truly play golf within the confines of the golf course. And so you would see some knockoff models, shall we say, of TPC courses that probably were far too penal because of there was just probably not that bit of insight as to how will this actually play? How will this actually play?
It looked like it, but it didn't.
Exactly. Visually, because it might have mounds and pot bunkers or water down the side or certain angles and things. People always, it's the same. But when it came down to the ability to maneuver your golf ball through the golf course and be successful, a lot of times, you know, other people just didn't have the same insights that Pete did as to how to make that work.
So, obviously, Pete Dye had a big influence on your career. Who would you say are some other, like, golden age architects that you draw influence from?
Well, again, having grown up in North Carolina and been exposed to a lot of Don Ross courses, I would have to say Mr. Ross, without question. I played a lot of his courses when I was a kid, and of course since then. But then Perry Maxwell, because of Old Town. And mentioned earlier about the genius of the routing of Old Town on a fairly severe, relatively small site. But the greens contours, Old Town had some of the most amazing greens, and with regard to internal contours and the putting surface, the Maxwell rolls, as they were called. And at the time when I was playing at Old Town, I'd never seen Southern Hills or Prairie Dunes or Crystal Downs or other courses that Mr. Maxwell had designed. And so I just didn't know. I just thought these greens are amazing and they're interesting. And they were so different than other places you'd go, because the contours were internal to the putting surface. They weren't all on the edges, mm-hmm. feeding down in and then disappearing in the putting surfaces. These, you might start quietly on the edges and then something, a Maxwell roll, will appear, which you use beautifully to separate levels. You know, in the green. So that's not Perry Maxwell and Donald Ross. And then, of course, as soon as you go see McKenzie courses, I guess we've all, you know, they're so inspirational in their vision and the creativity that you go, wow, look at that. Whoever thought of that? And then you go see, you know, C.B. McDonald or Seth Rayner things, and you go, how could it ever think of that? Who would have ever thought of that? And so when you start putting it, it all comes in layers. But Ross was the very early layer, followed by Maxwell, and then followed by, you know, others, but certainly including McKenzie.
So you could build like a super team, you know, of golden age architects. You can have somebody do multiple tasks, but you have somebody doing greens, routing, and we'll say strategy, and another guy doing like the aesthetics and bunkering. How would you put it together?
Well, I don't know, Andy. I mean, those guys were all good at all those things. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that any one of them was, you know, I'd say it was the absolute best among the names you mentioned at any one of those. I think McKenzie certainly had a flair for the visual, inspirational presentation. I mean, it's just, you go to his courses and just the visuals alone, and of course that has to do with the sites he got to work with too, but I don't know that I've ever walked onto or off of a McKenzie course that you just didn't find inspiring. And, you know, having said that, the Maxwell courses, truly, truly extraordinary. Were they maybe as visually inspiring as McKenzie courses? Maybe not. But I've never seen a Maxwell course. It wasn't well routed. But more than that, it was the greens. It was the green contouring. But can you say Maxwell's greens were better than Ross's greens, or better than McKenzie's greens? No, they're just different. That's what made the whole era so interesting. From a golf architecture perspective, you just had all these different perspectives, different presentations that were being put forth, all of which were based upon trying to complement the natural landscapes they had to work with, find interesting sites, and then showcase those and bring to life the golf in the most natural fashion from those interesting sites. So I truly don't think I can say, oh, this one was better at this, that one was better at that. That's pretty much toss-up type material there.
They're all really great.
Yeah.
And they're all different. That's, you know, unique and different.
You go to a McKenzie course at Cypress Point or, you know, something, and you walk around and say, oh, man, this is some of the most interesting, you know, certainly landscape, some of the most beautiful course in the world probably, but the greens are really interesting and this and that and the other. And then you go Prairie Dunes, you go, wow, these may be some of the most interesting greens ever. And then you go to just different places, and as soon as you think something's the best, oftentimes you walk off from another course. Wow, I thought that was good. Maybe this is just as good. You know, it's fascinating to walk around Oakmont. Then you look at it and you go, this may be the most amazing set of greens in the world. You know, in terms of contours in the greens, and that to me is just the beauty of it. There's no one has an absolute lock on the best.
It's so much different. I felt the same way this summer. I played some really great spots, and every time I'd walk up, perfect example, I played Sandhills. I was like, man, that was unbelievable. And then, a month or so later, I got the chance to play Crystal Downs. Hmm. And I walked off that, and I was like, that might be the best course in the world. But it's like if I went back the next day and played samples, I'd probably feel the exact same way.
Yeah. Well, that's true. That's how I look at some of these, you know, different journalistic, rankings.
Mm-hmm.
It's all fascinating to read and all this, but I look at them and go, really, can there be a number one golf course in the world? I just don't think that's possible. I guess you might put lumped together 50 or so that I think in any given day you could go to any one of them and say, I think this is the best course in the world or the best course ever played. And then go to the other 49 and probably say the same thing.
And like, how can you compare Sandhills, which you guys have 8,000 acres to route, versus like Marion, which is routed on that tiny little property.
Yeah.
It's like, and they're so distinctly different. One can't be better. They're just different, but they're both great.
Well, and that's, if there's been a problem with golf architecture, Andy, it's any time it becomes more stereotyped,
mm-hmm.
that's when the problem occurs. Because like you're saying, what you want is as much variety as possible. It's, you don't want every course looking like some other course. I mean, Ben and I both to this day, if we can somehow create a golf course that looks like the site it's on, that looks like it belongs there, and has great individual character, we're extraordinarily pleased with the results. And I think those courses that you're describing that were, you know, done many decades ago, you might recognize them as of coming out of a certain design philosophy sort of thing, but they had no apparent connection in terms of visuals or, you know, they weren't trying to just mass produce courses. Each one was a complement to the landscape it was put upon. And yes, you could go to one of those courses wherever and say, this might be the best course I've ever seen, only to do the exact same thing a week later in some far off place.
It's the beauty of golf. Yeah. Variety is the key to everything within one course and, you know, within courses across the country. And it's so with that, everybody always points to your, you know, these magnificent sites that you guys get to build on. But I'm really interested in, you know, the places like Talking Stick, Chichese Creek, and Trinity Forest, where they're flatter, there's less features. Like, Do you guys approach those sites differently than in terms of kind of how you go about building them? Do you have to do more stuff with those, or is it, you know, a similar philosophy?
Well, I mean, there are some sites, you know, Andy, we've been on, the guys that have been so extraordinarily blessed, I guess, would be an apt description, in that we've been given some truly special sites to work with, sites that were so naturally gifted for golf. And a number of those sites have, you know, have produced courses that people consider to be very special, and folks talk about a lot, and are there high up in the rankings of the U.S. or the world or whatever. You know, we look at those and we're so grateful for those opportunities. And yet you mentioned Talking Stick. Mm-hmm. Talking Stick's probably the worst site, one of the worst sites we've ever had. It was so flat. It's 400 acres for 36 holes. And I absolutely remember putting a Coca-Cola can at one end of the 400 acres, going to the other end of the 400 acres where the binoculars could see the Coca-Cola can sitting on the ground. That's how flat it was. And there was one tree on the site. It was not good soil. And, you know, I remember going out there with Dana Garmy, who, you know, founded Troon Golf, and they were going to manage the construction and the operational side for the tribal community there in Arizona. And I remember Dana just said, "Why don't you build two different golf courses out here?" He just kind of smiled, looked at me. He said, "We had looked at some sites before that I thought were too steep and too, you know, we just didn't know how to work with." Mm-hmm. He said, "I don't think you can tell me this is too severe." And I said, "Well, Dana, that's true." And we laughed about it, so still do to this day. But the potential for that site, Andy, was minimal, mm-hmm. at best, as opposed to the potential for a site, whether it's like Sandhills in Nebraska, or Cabot, you know, Nova Scotia, or other sites that we've had to work with, or, well, here in Sand Valley. But there's some sites that have the potential that if you don't create something that's truly one of the special golf courses in, you know, make the definition here, but at sometimes in the world, you know, people say the Sandhills, "Oh, that must have been so much fun." And this, I can't truthfully say that was a lot of fun. Yeah. You're out there on the site, the wind's blowing 30 miles an hour half the time. It's blowing away as fast as you can build it. But in the back of your mind, you know that if you don't build on the world's outstanding golf course, you failed. Mm-hmm. So the potential was so extreme, and the margin for success so small. Talking Stick, on the other hand, the potential was so minimal. And the opportunity for success, you think, "Boy, we don't have to do much to make this better if we can build anything that resembles interesting golf." So to this day, when I go, and I live in Scottsdale, so when I go out there, the parking lot's full. There are people playing golf. They have repeat play. This will be their 20th year they've been open. And I sometimes just stop and I just look around and, I think people, journalists particularly, like to ask all the time, "What's the best course you've ever done?" Well, how do you measure success? How do you define best, whatever? If best is defined by taking what its potential was and going beyond that to a certain, where, at what point did you go beyond its potential to the point that people enjoy playing it for 20 years and keep coming back again and again? Make Talking Stick. You could make an argument that Talking Stick may be the best thing that you've ever done.
I had a great experience when I was in Phoenix for work, and I was working for a startup, and they They booked me an Airbnb, and I was there for 2 weeks. Mm. And they booked me an Airbnb, and I stayed in these people's house with them. I had never, met these people.
Yeah.
And the first night I'm there, I got the terrible flu,
mm.
and I was laid up for the whole week. And then I felt okay to play golf on Saturday late afternoon. I went out to Talking Stick. And they had a concert festival going on.
Yeah.
So I got to play out there. There was nobody out there, late. And I was listening to music, just playing. And I had such a good time out there. I always like looking at an architect's work on flat ground. I always think Seth Rainer did such a good job with his, a lot of sites that weren't, he didn't have a lot of great sites.
Yeah.
And Donald Ross is another one that came to mind that really utilized what he had really well. And do you think a great judge of looking at an architect's work is what they did with their worst site?
Well, it's certainly something to be considered. Mm-hmm. It's one thing to take an extraordinarily gifted site and not mess it up.
Mm-hmm.
That's the fear of having a truly, truly special site. But yes, it's another thing to take a site with little or no potential and actually out of it comes something that proves over a lengthy period to be appreciated. So, yeah, I think so. I mean, I remember Talking Stick, Andy. You have to, when you go out there now or when you played, of course, they planted lots of trees and creosote bushes grew up and all this and the other, but we staked out 36 holes. And, they had the PVC poles stuck up for the greens, landing areas, tees and that sort of thing. You could see every pole. You could stand in one spot, see every single pole for every point on all 36 holes. It looked like a punji stick trap out there. It just looked like, straws sticking up everywhere. And you just stood there. You didn't know where you went from one pole to the next. It was just like, I remember talking to Ben, and I said, Ben, if you've ever had any theoretical holes on flat ground you wanted to build, now's the time, because we got to come up with 36 holes from nothing, zero. There was not one contour on the contour map. It was just white. And so we just sat there, and Dave Axlin, who's worked with us for so many years, and they said, well, what would you like to start with? Because it told us kind of where they would like the clubhouse to be from an entry road, because at one time they were considering building a hotel internal between the two golf courses. And that's why there's that space
right
there, kind of the hole in the donut right next to the clubhouse that both courses wrap around. And so it's okay. At least we have a starting point. We'll go from here. And from that point on, it was purely theoretical. And people say, why would you guys ever do that? Well, we had finished the Sandhills very soon before that. So we'd come and we were doing a course in Georgia called Cuscawilla at the time. Sandhills, extraordinary site where you just followed exactly what the ground was going to give you. Cuscawilla, another interesting site, very different than Sandhills, but very interesting, where you followed the ground. Mm-hmm. And then we looked at Target and said, well, there's nothing to guide us here. Let's just see if we can do this.
Variety in sites.
Yes, true variety in sites, yeah.
So did you guys just kind of let your imagination run wild there? Or was there anything in particular with it being flat that you really, you said, we need to have this kind of interest, create interest here more so than anywhere else?
Well, the gold again, as I would kid Dana Garmley, I said, now you're telling me you want two totally different golf courses on this site. He said, yes. Okay, good luck. And but there was an attempt made to make the South Course. They've just been recently renamed, so I'm going to mess this up.
I think I played the North Course.
I'm going to stick with the South. And but the south course more of a parkland type course with elevated greens and greenside bunkers, and then there were more trees and there was a bit of water and that sort of thing. So it was intended to have more of that feel. The north course was meant to be the low profile, rolled off greens, not severe like Pinehurst, but still crowned off, bunkers lower profile, and more open, windswept, you know, feeling. And in the mix, but between all of that, there is a major drainage area that goes down through it. So we did create all these lows. You might not notice them much if you're out there. Mm-hmm. It created all the lows that would allow water to enter from way at the north end of the property and eventually work its way out the south. But we just did it differently than probably most of the courses that have been done in the desert. Most of them do the mounding on the edges of the property, mm-hmm. and then start to work inward. We left the edges of the property just flat, yeah. like the desert, and then start doing the contours. The more in away from the edges you get, the more contour there is. So it went inward and downward and upward and that sort of thing. So it's at least to us, it just felt a little more natural.
As I remember that, when the third, I think it's the third hole on the north course, it's a par four, long par four on the boundary line, and there's just nothing out
there. Yeah, well, that's what the whole property looked like. Yeah. Yeah,
I guess that's probably a good way to just go to the edges and you'll see what it was.
Well, it's interesting, you know, Andy, because the second hole on the north course there, the par five, uh-huh. goes right down that boundary.
That might
be. Yeah, it's a big fairway yeah. to the right. No fairway bunkers. Big fairway to the right. Out of bounds all the way down the left-hand side. And the green sitting right next to the out of bounds, you know, 520 yards or so down there, further down from yeah. the tee. And you stand on the tee, you look right down the out of bounds, you see the green, you see the flag. There's a bunker to the right of the green. But the key is the out of bounds, and the green sitting right next to it. And so you can play as far away from out of bounds as you want, but sooner or later you're going to deal with it. You can play the tee shot way away from out of bounds. You can play the second shot way away from out of bounds. Now you're faced with a potential pitch right over that bunker to a skinny green with the out of bounds right behind it. Mm-hmm. And if you avoid the out of bounds all with first two or three shots going yeah. down there. So at some point you take on the out of bounds. And Ben and I remember we were doing this day facts when we were all out there. Where no one's gonna understand this hole. No one. And sure enough we got some I don't know that they do this anymore, but back then Golf Digest, you get some comments back from the Raiders, you know, when they were evaluating the quote best new courses or something that had been nominated. So Ben, I loved it because we read through some of the comments. You know, they were not named by who mm-hmm. said them, but one of the comments from one of the Golf Digest Raiders was, "This is the worst golf hole I've ever seen." And then I just got tickled. And yeah, nobody's gonna ever understand this. And yet, Jeff Ogilvy, you know, who lives in Scottsdale and who's a very ardent student of architecture as well, has been such an extraordinary player. I've heard him say it's just a fascinating hole. It's just, you know, for that very reason, you have to deal with out of bounds at some point.
Yeah.
And the old, what was that old commercial? Pay me now or pay me later.
Yeah. I had talked with Ogilvy one time about architecture, and he, speaking exactly to this hole, he made an analogy that I will never forget. It was maybe one of the best golf course architecture analogies I've ever heard. He said, imagine a tennis match between Rafa Nadal and Roger Federer where they could only hit it right down the middle of the court all game. How exciting would that be? Extremely boring. The interest is on the edges, and when they have to play to the edges to win, and it's just like this, yeah. the second hole of talking stick, is eventually you have to play to the edge
yeah.
if you want to score.
Yeah.
And that's where the interest comes.
Yeah. No, that is a beautiful way to put it, and he's absolutely correct. It's you know, it gets into that whole discussion about width, how much width you need for interest. And there for a lot of years, we went to, you know, things became more and more constricted in terms of width of fairways, which basically rendered playing golf much like that description of watching two extraordinary tennis players just say you cannot hit it anywhere but right down the middle of the court. It's not particularly that interesting. It's when you start to play the edges to gain an advantage. And if the course has edges and gives you a reason to play close to them to gain an advantage, that's when it becomes really exciting. But talking stick, Andy, maybe we didn't. We've always said, and people have kidded us, but it's true. We look for whatever features we can to give inspiration to holes, you know, features that exist on the property. And talking stick, one tree, there was one little ditch, I mean, tiny little ditch that some poor person had tried to dig, I'm sure, many years ago to direct water in case it ever rains, which seldom does. But that ditch still exists. It's on the right-hand side of, I think it's number 7 now. One time it was, maybe it's 10, on the north course.
Yeah.
There's a little ditch over there. They switched the numbers of those, but it goes straight away. It's a hole that goes straight away from the clubhouse, mm-hmm. you know, there to the north. And there's this tiny little ditch, just straight as it can be. And we thought, well, we just make a hole go right down that ditch. Mm-hmm. And if you can play close to it, it's on the right versus the out of bounds on the left on the second hole you were talking about. So at times you get desperate, you start looking for things. What can we mm-hmm. some inspiration for a hole?
Yeah, it's that. How do you with it? So switching gears and going from talking stick to sand hills, like there you had probably the complete opposite feeling of, you know, feature overload. What was the most difficult thing about going from, I think it was 132 holes to 18?
Well, you know, Andy, we always knew, I mean, yes, we had many, many holes, 132, 136, I can't remember exactly now. They're still, most of them, I think, are still on a little piece of paper I used to carry around in my pocket. Mm-hmm. When I would go up there, and they're just tiny little marks, you know, that didn't mean anything to anyone but me personally. I knew where one of those little marks was. I could go out and find it and stuff for individual holes. But as soon as you started to say, I really want this hole, most often that cut across some of the other potential holes. So you started eliminating things. The big thing with sandhills is trying to truly believe going into it as you start construction that you pick the best one. And that's just pure judgment call. It's do we like the sequence of the holes? Do we like the directions? Do we like the feel as you're progressing? Do we like the way the course is moving through the bigger dunes and then the softer dunes? We're trying to get it, again, to your point, variety. You know, I've heard people who said, oh, gee, you should have put more holes up in those giant dunes. Well, understand that from a visual perspective, but golf's played on the ground and at sandhills and you know, walking and playing golf, and we just felt like it should be a nice combination of that landscape, big dunes, small dunes, in between sizes. Mm. And so you just try to start to analyze all the different, you find individual holes that you'd really like to build, but you try to then start figuring out what's the circulation pattern? How best to get around this property in this interesting fashion and showcase the most interesting elements? And what are the best individual holes to do that? And pretty soon you start picking a few, and a lot of them a lot of others start following, by the way. But it is. It's one of our biggest concerns in that was that we finished the course and then look back and say, oh, we should have done that. We should have done that, you know. And I can very candidly say, I think if you talk to Ben, certainly if you talk to me, I think we would both very quickly say, no, we're happy with the ones we picked.
Feelings you have to be in the bed.
I think I could see that perspective, but I actually do believe we do feel it. I don't think we've been trying to talk ourselves into it. I remember playing golf out there before the course opened, just Ben and me.
Yeah.
We played, we were walking down. I remember we got to the 17th hole, and, you know, of course, we both knew all the different discussions that had gone on, different ways to go. And I remember looking at Ben and saying, would you change anything? And he said, no. And that's just the two of us standing there. There's no one listening. Yeah. There's no one. It's not like, God, we probably should have taken that hole over there or that one instead of this. There was none of that. We were very comfortable. And I think for both of us, that was real. I mean, if we had had any inclination that, no, we missed it, we would have admitted it. And so I don't think it's just like we just said it to make ourselves feel better, or, you know. Mm-hmm.
So Kyle Hagelin, who was on the podcast, said you know, there was a big argument with you and Dick Youngstaff about the fourth green.
Oh, God.
And you know, you move some stuff around there. And who do you think? Do you think Dick would admit you were right now?
You'd have to ask Dick. Dick's such a good friend. I just think the absolute world of Dick. And but yeah, he wasn't very happy with me. And he was not happy with me. You'd have to ask Dick what his opinion of that is. But yeah, he always envisioned, he and I had gone out there actually one day, and I don't think I'm saying something I shouldn't say, but Dick might disagree with this, but I don't think so. But we'd gone out there one day, just the two of us, and I told Dick that we were thinking about building the green up there where it is.
Uh-huh.
And we were gonna use that, what became that big blowout bunker short left, to create the sand to then pile against the natural dune to make the green. And it was gonna be one sort of inspired by the fifth green at Prairie Dunes, in case you happen to know that, where Maxwell did a very similar thing. Pile of sand out next, off the side of a dune, then with a drop off, you know, beside that green. And Dick was talking to me. He said, Bill, why don't you build the green down here low to the right? And Dick didn't often do that type of stuff. You know, he just said, I want you to do the least of the property you can. And that's why I think he was saying, why don't you build the green down here low to the right? Because he's going, why would you dig that sand out there and pile it up there to build the green? You could just build it down here low, right? And Ben and I talked about this quite a bit. And we both just felt like it was more interesting sitting up there. Yeah. And so I went through all that with Dick, and he and I. And at the end of that day, I sincerely believed that Dick was in agreement we'd build the green up there high left. Dick sincerely believed we were in agreement we were going to build it down there low right. And so we went our separate ways, and Dick went off for, I don't know, a few days. I can't remember. He's usually there all the time, but he went off for a few days. And meanwhile, went up there the very next day and start building the green up top. And,
what do they say when the cat's away, the mice?
Yeah, exactly. And so Dick came back. He was not happy. It was the only time we really, I don't think he spoke to me for like 2 weeks thereafter. And I was spending most all the summer up there, so he was not very happy with me. But the most, at least for me, maybe the most amusing part is the first picture ever published of the Sand Hills Golf Club. Ron Whitten from Golf Digest was up there. And as the course was just about grown in, Ron was taking some photographs, and he wrote a piece about the sand hills. And there's a double page spread, one photograph of the fourth green. And Dick saw that. And he got, he looked at me and goes, "You did this? I know you did this. I know you set this up." He was convinced, which I had nothing to do. I didn't even know they were going to. I knew Ron had been up there and was going to do a piece about it, but no idea what picture they were going to make. But to this day, Dick's convinced that I had that set up with Ron to run that big picture, double page picture of the fourth hole at the sand hills.
With regard to the Dick, with him being a successful building architect, do you think that helps with him being, you know, the working with you guys like in a little bit more hands-off role? Like, do you think him being an architect helped the success of that project?
Well, I think that was a very big contributing factor. His understanding building in general and design in the process. But Andy, Dick Young's kept simply the only human being I've ever met that I truly believe could pull that project off. Mm-hmm. As much as I admire so many people for whom we've worked and people I've met who've been so successful, I don't know anyone else that could have made that happen. The combination of patience, but concept and the ability to communicate with the local community, the ranching community there, and then just to convince anyone that's had any hope possibility. I mean, you put it in the context, people look back now probably and say, "Oh, well, okay, yeah, it happened." Well, you can only imagine trying to go out and convince someone, because Dick's not a wealthy man, mm-hmm. and go out and try to convince someone that they should invest in the building of a golf course in Sand Hills, Nebraska, where the population base averages 2 people per square mile. And, you know, it's like, really? You're going to do this? And I remember a guy that Ben and I knew very well from back east, and he'd gone out there to look at it. And he summed it all up to me when he called. He goes, "Bill, there are no people. There's no one there. You're going to build a golf course there." And so, yeah, Dick, his ability to pull off that and the faith that people who invested with him had in Dick, it wasn't in us and it wasn't in that concept, because the concept was just like seeing pure folly. Mm-hmm. And you know, you hear a Crump's Folly at Pine Valley. Well, it, you know, books are written about that, but Dick's, this idea of going out there and doing this was perceived by almost everyone who saw it as absolute folly.
What was you and Ben's reaction when he first called you and told you the idea? Like, without seeing the site?
Well, first of all, Andy, Ben had seen pictures in an old National Geographic magazine. I can't remember from when. Could have been the 60s, late 1960s. But he had seen pictures in an article that was in National Geographic about the sand hills of Nebraska. And it was a fairly lengthy article. It had stories of the ranching families and things, but talked about the geology of the site and all the sand dunes and ridges. So Ben remembered those photographs of those dunes from that article. I had first heard about the sand hills in Nebraska from Doug Peterson, who was longtime superintendent of Prairie Dunes. Later ended up coming to be the superintendent of the Austin Golf Club that we did in Austin. But I remember back in the 1980s walking with Doug down the 8th hole at Prairie Dunes, and I made some comments. And can you imagine having a piece of property like this to build a course on? And Doug was originally from Nebraska. And he looked at me in his very gravelly voice. He says, "Bill, I know where there's land better than this for golf." I go, what? I go, where is it? He said, Nebraska. Well, I'd never been in the state of Nebraska. I thought Nebraska was just flat, cornfields, mm-hmm. you know, and stuff. He goes, no, there's a big sand dune area. He said, I've been through it many times. He said, it's fabulous. He said, probably never be a golf course there because there are no people. He said, but he said, it's fabulous land for golf. Ron Whitten from Golf Digest, you know, from Nebraska.
Yeah.
He knew about it. But the fact that when Dick called, I remember vividly being in the office with Ben and Scott Sayers, our business manager, all these years. And Dick got on, you know, we got on a conference call for Dick. And he said, guys, I'm calling to see if you'd have any interest in coming to the sand hills of Nebraska to look at a site. Well, I think he started off saying, look at a site in Nebraska. There's, you know. Of course, Dick can't see us. We're just sitting there. We're listening. And all of a sudden, he says, in a park called the Sand Hills of Nebraska. I'm sure you've never heard of it. I look at Ben. He looks at me. And he thought of that National Geographic thing, and I thought of Doug Pearson.
Yeah.
Here we go. We'll be there. We'll come see you.
That's amazing. When you drive in there, you see golf everywhere, but I imagine I think the thing that sticks out to me, there are spectacular green complexes, but the scale and having that scale to be able to use it in a strategic way. I mean, that's got to be so rare on all your sites to have that kind of intimidation factor with the bunkers, right?
Well, and the bunkers certainly were inspired by just the natural blowouts that occur from wind erosion there in the sand hills. And so, you know, we saw those and said, okay, that needs to be the model for the bunkers out here. And, of course, the ranchers, whom we got to know very well through the process, but they all thought we were just completely lost our minds because they're trying to get those sandy blowouts to heal over.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so they don't just keep getting bigger and bigger. And here we are making some. And but it was interesting to listen. One of the ranchers was out there one day, and I was talking about something. I said, well, I think we're going to make this sandy blowout over here. And he goes, well, you can, but it would never occur naturally there. Mm-hmm. And, well, okay. He said, that's faced the wrong direction. And, you know, cattle don't go through there. And most of the blowouts occurred when there was some traffic pattern going through up a dune. It'd wear a spot, and then pretty soon the wind would start blowing and blowing it, like the giant bunker that's there left of 18 at the sand hills.
Mm-hmm.
That's there because of the windmill that's there, because the cows would go through, and they'd always go to the windmill. They'd come down from the top, down the dunes. They'd come from the bottom. They'd come across what's in front of number one at the sand hills. And so when we got there, that was just this magnificent sandy expanse and thing, all caused by the cattle coming down to the windmill that pumped the water into the holding tank there.
Yeah, I've heard that a lot of people have been asking you about camping out on sites and routing, and I have to apologize. You know, one of your friends told me you did that, and.
I think I know who that friend was. Yeah, I had a young guy walk up to me in Branson not long ago who was working on the course, and he asked me that same thing. He says, is it true that you take a tent and pitch tent out on the site and start walking and following all the animal trails? And I go, I think that rumor has been embellished. No, I had never pitched a tent out on the site. And that. Have I followed animal trails? Absolutely. It's been my sense walking sites, particularly wooded, hilly sites, that animals figure out the easiest way to traverse the property.
Mm-hmm.
And generally it's in search of water or going to and from water. But they find the ways to get around the severe parts of the property in the least taxing way. So if you're going to a site, you know, not anything to begin, but you find a nice deer trail, cattle trail, whatever, elk trail, whatever it may be, generally, it's going to find its way from high ground to low ground, probably back to high ground, in a way that's not horrible to walk. Plus, if you're in the bushes in the woods, you already got a bit of a trail to follow.
You're not finding it as much.
Exactly. So it's we always start out trying to determine the circulation pattern around the piece of property and find the most interesting parts, elements of the property. And then if you were to go out there and just walk that property to see it, not even thinking about golf, if you were to go out there and spend the day walking around that property and try to see the interesting parts, the vistas, the long-term vistas, but also maybe the rock outcroppings or interesting trees or interesting stream or what break, whatever it might be. Once you knew those things were there, how would you go walk about through the day and do it where you could see those things and not feel like you're mountain climbing or you're not feeling like you're just doing it where it's just a physical challenge? How would you make it an enjoyable walk through property? So we sort of look at routing like that. How would you walk through this? How would you go through this property and touch upon the most interesting elements and do it in a way that's not physically, overly physically taxing? So that's kind of how we do that. But yeah, the animal trails play into that. I made the mistake, Andy, I said that some years ago. Ben and I were doing an interview with the media thing for the PGA Senior Championship at Colorado Golf Club. Mm-hmm. And during that, they had someone asked the question about, we hear you sometimes walk around on animal trails. And so I basically said what I just said. Next thing I know, I think it was Gary Koch, I'm not sure, but one of the commentators for the championship says this out on the air, and it comes out across like, oh, they just lay out the holes based on the animal trails. You know, well, it's not quite right, but it is a good guide. Yeah. Bandon Trails was full of trails, both animal trails and hiking trails. So that's why it has that name, mm-hmm. Trails. I used to walk out there for days and days and days and study the property and make notes and maps and things. But some of that stuff, the gorse and stuff, you could physically walk through anyway.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of holes in abandoned trails that were laid out, kind of following trails. Mm-hmm.
As if you had run with the camping story, you would have inspired a whole new generation of architects that spent their time camping on their sites.
Yeah, I know. When you read those stories about Perry Maxwell at Prairie Dunes, supposedly, you know, being out there with some apples and water and a tent. If I'm not mistaken, Mr. Maxwell had already lost one leg by this time. I doubt that he was out in the sand in the dunes there, Prairie Dunes. Mm-hmm. You know, well, he may have had apples and water with him and a way to get around, but I doubt that he was just camping out out there, you know.